verse 20, through him to reconcile all things unto himself. Now, we probably talked a bit about that also, but to reconcile means to change from one position to another. And we were changed from a position of being separated from God to a position of being part of his family. That's what reconciliation is all about. It is a relief or release from the bondage of this material world, which holds people prisoner. It's a release from the bondage of satanic power, which holds our minds prisoner. The word has the idea of release in it. So he has reconciled all things unto himself, having made peace through the blood of his cross. Now, peace is the common utterance of this world's philosophical crowd. People always want peace. And there used to be a phrase that people used, peace, brother. And people used to hold up a couple of fingers for peace, a sign of or victory. Everybody talks about peace, but the question really is, what kind of peace are we talking about? There's one kind of peace that is merely the cessation of hostilities, to cease from hostility. If people are not shooting each other, they call that peace. Some marriages function on a sort of armed truce basis. There's peace there, but it's only that they've agreed not to kill each other temporarily. Inside, there's not that much peace going on. The word in Greek has great kin to the word serenity or harmony, better yet, harmony. True peace is where you have your head together. You're able to integrate all the facets of your life in that context. If you know where you're at, where you're coming from, to use some colloquialisms, if you know where you're coming from, you can take any kind of problem that you have and work it into that, or work it out by that standard. These things carry across. So you develop certain principles by which you live, by which you analyze the world and life, and then you apply those principles to all your situations. And so you have peace because you're at peace inside of yourself. Part of that process, for example, is to have come to terms with the material world. That is, coming to terms with it means that you learn how to use it but not abuse it. That is, you learn how to handle material things, how to live with them, but not be dominated by them. One buys a house, for example, as has been the recent experience of some of you. That house can either become a millstone around the neck, wherein your whole life is given to the house, or it can be a useful part of your life. See? But the people that are just all their free moments out there scraping and painting and dusting and mowing and all the rest of things, you see, they're letting the tail wag the dog. They're letting the house live in them rather than they're living in the house. The house occupies them when they should be occupying the house. That's the whole difference. If you occupy the house, it's a useful item. If the house occupies you, it's a millstone around your neck. You have to learn to keep all these things in perspective. Peace begins with a standard or a pattern upon which you can bring all of life's issues to terms. Now, for us, that standard or pattern means Christ. I think for anyone, it's got to mean something to do with getting it together with God. And then when you have that criterion, thus when you come to the house, if you see yourself beginning to be overcome by the house, you stop and say, wait a minute, this is only material world. So peace means the harmonization of your life and bringing all things in your life to terms with that which is the essence of your life, which now is Christ. your constant question thus is, how does this affect me as far as Christ is concerned, as far as my relationship to Christ? If it's something that tends to draw you away from Christ, then you check it, you see. If you're with a group of people too much that draw you away from Christ, you just back away from that, because that's not worth the price to barter your relationship to Christ for sometime friends, you know, and they are all friends or sometime friends, you know, they're there when you are bright and cheery, and they're gone when you're sad and dreary. Now, if you've got peace within, you can stand a good deal of pressure without. Things can fall apart in a lot of different ways, and still you can pull your head together to keep your life flowing in a peaceful stream. Now, I would like to be sure you understand the difference between peace in the spirit and peace in the flesh, in the natural. If I ever use the expression flesh, what I'm really talking about is the natural person, which includes the psyche and the physical being. The psyche being your mental powers, including the intellect, the emotions, and the will. All that is part of your psyche. And that is a natural process in you. There's a great deal that goes on in the way of habit and conduct that is part of the natural psyche. The other part of you is spirit, and those are two different sectors. Now, it is quite possible to have peace in the spirit, but not in the natural mind. As long as Christ is there, you will always have peace in your spirit. That means that at the gut level, you know somehow that things are still stable. But on the surface, there's an awful lot of waves, a lot of turbulence. If you don't understand this point, you're going to be in trouble most of the time, because life is a troublesome thing. Whether it's the cat getting hair all over your best sofa, or your friend knocking over your favorite vase, or your husband jumping on you for ramming the car into the wall in the back door. Whatever it is, life is almost continuously turbulent. In one way or another, it's troublesome as a way. You've got people at work trouble you, people at home trouble you, everything is troublesome. But that doesn't mean that you can't have peace deep within you. The other is just a surface thing. You will have peace in the flesh, the natural man, only to the degree that you're willing to set aside the things in the flesh that are troublesome. For example, a person who gets too big an appetite for material goods might way overextend themselves in terms of credit. Now you're going to have turbulence. It has nothing to do with your salvation. Christ is still in you. You still have peace with God. But the creditors are not happy with you. So there's turbulence. And until you get your debts paid off, you're going to wake up in the morning with a knot in your gut. And that's the way it is. It's too big a problem. There's too much money involved. You're going to be troubled about it if you overextend yourself. Or if you get careless about your eating habits or your living habits, and then you get physical problems, that's going to be troublesome to you. But still your spirit can be at peace and strong. So your peace in the flesh, in the natural man, you pretty well have to govern that yourself. You have to ask what it's worth to you to have tranquility. I'd actually rather use the word tranquility for the natural psyche, which means a passive situation. Tranquility versus peace in the spirit. So your tranquility in the natural person will be directly proportionate to the focus that you have in your flesh. If you buy a new car, and that new car is merely a means of transportation in some degree of safety and comfort, you're not going to be devastated if you get a scratch on it. But if that car is the pride and joy of your life, the least little scratch is going to cause you considerable trouble. I want you to understand that you gauge the measure of peace you can have in your natural person by how you approach your life. But peace in the spirit, that is something else. That's something God gives you. And it's always there. And as long as you recognize that you have peace with Christ, even though things might be a little turbulent and twisted down here on the earth, if you understand that, you're going to be all right. All of this going back to the point that Jesus Christ, by his death on the cross, made peace for us. It says, through the blood of his cross. Of course, the shedding of blood is primarily, it stands for dying. The blood of Christ does not of itself have any special curative powers. In other words, had they been able to preserve a bottle of Jesus' blood, that would have no more power in it per se as blood than ours does. So when we say the blood of Christ or the blood of his cross, we're really talking about the fact that he let his life blood go out for our sakes, and we're talking now about death. He made peace through the death of or blood of his cross. Through him, whether things upon earth or things in the heavens. There is an entire universe to really come under the aegis of the cross of Christ. But I would like to say about this cross that it's quite a mystery just how exactly the cross of Christ 2,000 years ago can do anything effectively for us, or how it is that God himself can come down and die for us, and so on. And I caution you not to try in your natural mind to apply the cross to yourself. Just accept the idea that Christ was slain. The cross, the reason they used the cross, that is the reason God chose it, is that it represents probably the greatest possible humiliation. To hang on a cross was a humiliation for one. It was reserved for those criminals that the state wanted to make a public example of. That's why I hung them on the cross. Now, just as I said about the blood, so the cross. There's no power in a cross. And if you wear one on your lapel or on your neck to give you good luck, you're crazy, because it doesn't do that. Anything that one would use as a luck charm is in distinction from what Christ would want, because he doesn't deal in luck. So people would take a cross and hang it around their neck for luck or protection or whatever else are really missing the whole point. The blood of the cross is the death of Christ, and that death of Christ is what brings us peace and, of course, new life.
Dave?
Yes?
I know a lot of people use the cross as a symbol for either resurrection or there's one mediator between God and man. Is that, you know, repeat that in the Bible anywhere?
I don't know that they're justified in using it as a symbol for that reason. The cross was merely a brutal way to die. The object lesson is that the cross was the fullest expression of human degradation. In fact, we've got that poem in the dealing with the cross. Let's look at that. Into the abyss he came. That's the name of the poem here. Into the abyss of human misery he came. And though a babe, yet was his heart aflame with the glory of God. Into the abyss, the glory of God for the world of men. Into the abyss, where once he dared to drink the cup of sorrow, and then faced the consequence of that abyss, and bore upon his flawless frame the symbols of all human sin expressed. You see this? Now, of course, abyss means the deep, you know, the abyss, the pit. He bore upon his flawless frame the symbols of all human sin expressed. You see what we mean by that? All the degradation of man, all man's rottenness is expressed in the way they brutalized Jesus on the cross. That's what the cross really represented. He faced the consequence of that abyss and bore upon his flawless frame the symbols of all human sin expressed. And in a tragic stroke, the grand illusions laid to rest of man's inherent dignity. You see, the dignity of man comes apart as he brutalizes Jesus on the cross. Strange it is that all the tragedies of time have not sufficed to prove to man the depths of that accursed clime to which his soul was born, nor has it dawned upon his darkened heart that e'en the noble things of man are part of vain facade, and all the liberty in which he revels to indulge his selfish soul is but a bondage from the chains of which the grace of God alone can set him free. And so, insensitive to all but grosser earthly things, and unaware the raft to which he blindly clings is rudderless and without sail, he drifts through life, grasping, striving, bearing fortune's perfidies, until that disenchanting moment when the spirit flees the mortal cage and knows that all he lived for was but ashes, and all the good he shunned, the stuff of which eternal bliss is made. Thus the abyss to which he came, the majesty of God enshrined for all the world to see, the blessed Son of Man. Into the abyss, the Son of God, with the power to free the souls of all, in one great deed of holy and unselfish love, and now on eagle's wings, the souls of those who will may soar, and unencumbered by the chains of demon power, know the thrill of life fulfilled, the joy of harmony with him in whom the timeless universe remains secure. That goes along with this chapter, this verse, very nicely. It's what we've been talking about. So the crucifixion of Jesus was the symbol of all human degradation. And by that death of Christ, our own sins are covered. And our identity with Christ lies in the willingness to bear his humiliation. That is, the willingness to be one with him. The willingness to recognize that for our sins, he was put upon that cross as well as the sins of the rest of the world. It's that humility. It's coming to him with that open heart that says, God, I need your help. I am a sinner. I want your help for me. That's the essence of our faith. You can see the arrogance of people who don't want to do this. They refuse to see themselves as needing that help. And every one of us is caught in the maelstrom of the human scene, and then our holiness, our purity, is from Christ, not from ourselves. He has made peace through that cross, and the road to the cross is through the valley of humiliation, where we take Jesus' place there with him. And then he says, and you being then alienated and enemies in your minds, that is your human understanding, in your evil deeds, now has he reconciled, the word again, has he brought back to himself in the body of his flesh through death to present you holy and unblameable and unreprovable, that is, unconvictable, before him. Now, to present you holy, you see, this word holy has got to be understood. People usually think of holy as somebody who's very, very good. But we're not very, very good. So how can he call us holy? Well, only in one way. The Greek word here for holy, hagios, means separated. Holy in the sense of sanctified or set apart for something. For example, the vessels of the temple were called holy because they were set apart for a particular service. You didn't eat Irish stew out of the vessels of the temple because that would be a desecration of them. Although a famous king in history drank wine out of one of the vessels of the temple. And that was just the night when his empire fell. Belshazzar, It's in the chapter 5 of Daniel, I think. Belshazzar made a feast. During this time, the children of Israel were captives in Babylon, where he reigned. And Babylon was regarded as impregnable. Well, the only thing is that there was one place, or some place in the wall, down underneath the river that was accessible. The point was that we want to make here. Belshazzar was making this feast, and he called for them to bring the vessels of the temple, the Jewish vessels. And he drank wine out of them. He just trying to give the Jews a bad time. And so he was going to do the ultimate of degradation, drink wine out of the vessels of the temple. Even while he was doing that, then all of a sudden these gold letters appeared on the wall behind him. You all are familiar probably with that story, that the handwriting on the wall has become a commonplace expression for us all. But that's what it referred to. That suddenly, while he was sitting there eating on the wall, there appeared these gold letters just flashed on there, or letters, I guess they were gold. The words were Mene, Mene, Tikal, Apharsin. M-E-N-E is said twice. That word means numbered, numbered. Tekel, T-E-K-E-L, means weighed. And Peres means divided. It comes out Mene, Mene, Tikal, Apharsin. Means numbered, numbered, weighed, divided. Daniel interpreted that to Belshazzar, and he said it means God has numbered your kingdom. That is, he's analyzed it. He's weighed you in the balances, and you're found wanting. And he says, this night shall your kingdom be divided and taken from you. And even while Daniel was talking, the Persian army was marching up the riverbed that they had dammed off, and Belshazzar was wiped out. Now that is a good story to illustrate the whole implication of the word holy. The vessels Belshazzar drank from were holy vessels. They had been set apart and sanctified unto God. And for him to drink out of them was a slap in the face of God. It wasn't that he was humiliating Israel. It was a slap at God. So he was wiped out for it. Now, we are, when the word holy is applied to us, which it is, the word saint is the same word. You didn't know it, but you're a saint. Did you know that?
I didn't
know that. You're a saint. Your name may never appear on the Gothic cathedrals, but you're a saint. Your statue much less likely. And sanctify means to make holy or to set apart. You're holy right now. The moment you come to Christ, you're holy as far as God is concerned, because you belong to Him. So you are being alienated and enemies in your minds, that now He has reconciled in the body of His flesh through death to present you holy and unblameable and unreprovable. Now none of these words yet say to us perfect. To be unblameable does not necessarily mean to be perfect. It means you're not going to have blame. God can't blame you because Christ has taken that on Himself. You can no longer be held accountable for that. There was a story about a judge back in Boston. I cannot vouch for the truth of this story, but I'll tell it anyway. The judge was hearing traffic matters. And he had become so disturbed at the number of traffic citations coming up in that city that he had vowed with some of the judges, and he said, the very next traffic case that comes up before me, I'm going to put them in jail. That's it. I've had it. The next case up was his wife. Now, what is he going to do? He can't let her off. He's made his promise. He can't send her to jail. He'd never be able to go home again. So what he did was to pronounce a sentence. He said, I sentence you to 24 hours city jail. And while she was bursting into tears, he took his robe off and came down there, and he says, I am also now going to serve that time for you. I'm just banning myself from the bench. Now I'm going to go and serve that time for you. He couldn't let her off. but he could serve the time for her. Now, see, God can't let us off and just pat us on the head and say, oh, you're nice people, I like you anyway. So he had let his son pay the price of, I mean, and himself, therefore, of course, that the son is merely an expression of himself. He went to the cross for us himself and paid the price. Now, we are not perfect. We are not guiltless, but we are absolved from guilt. We are unblameable. That woman was no longer blameable for this traffic matter. It had been taken care of. So you're not chargeable with crimes, even though you are or were guilty of those. By crimes, I'm talking about the general tendencies of the human person to do those things that are displeasing to God, selfishness and pride and all those things. So he says you are holy, that is, set apart, unblameable, and unreprovable, which is that you can't be called out now again for the same matter before him. If indeed, now here we're going to be very tough on you, if indeed you continue in the faith with a foundation under you and settled, and be not removed from the hope of the gospel which you have heard. Now, I have to remind you again that I am not great enough to be able to tell you that you can do anything you want and you're all right. So what I should say is the only way you can ever be saved is not by doing good deeds, but by the grace of Christ, identifying with him. Therefore, QED, the only way you could be lost would be not by doing bad deeds, but by walking away from Christ. The only way you could be lost would be to walk away from Christ. Now, I've said to you this before. I don't mean that you get on a lather some morning and you shout invectives at God and say, I hate you, God, and so forth. That can be just tantrum behavior. The Lord understands that in you like he understands it in a child. Satan wants you to walk away from it. One of the big things is to get you discouraged, to think, well, I'm no good anyway. I don't have any business getting along with Christ because, after all, we're both two different type of people. Now, don't let Satan kid you about that. Just stay with it. Stay with it. If indeed you are not removed from the hope of the gospel which you've heard and which has been proclaimed in all creation which is under heaven and of which I, Paul, have become a minister, that is, a servant. He says you're going to be presented holy, unblameable, and unreprovable in his sight if you stay with him. Anybody who wants to be part of Christ's family is going to be part of Christ's family. There's no need to worry about that, to think the Lord is going to drop you. The Lord is not going to kick you out. You might kick him out, but he's not going to kick you out. You might walk away. Now Paul says, I rejoice in my sufferings on your behalf, and fill up that which is lacking of the afflictions of Christ in my flesh on behalf of his body, which is the church, of which I have become a minister according to the dispensation of God which was given to me to fulfill the word of God. Simply stated, he's rejoicing in his sufferings because now he shares with Jesus in the suffering. That's a great gift to share with Jesus in going through this life. I was saying in another meeting yesterday that it seems desirable that once we become a Christian, the Lord would snap us up off the earth and transport us to heaven. Then we wouldn't have to go through all this mess. We think it would, but we'd miss all the fun. That'd be like being assigned to the football team. And just as you are ready to step onto the turf, the coach comes rushing up and says, hey man, good news. You don't have to play. We just tore up your contract. You can go back home. It's an honor to leave you here to fight, to go through the struggles, to say, well, I think this person and this person is sturdy enough to go through it, so I'm going to leave them here. Because you see, we're a great testimony to God. We're proof of the fact that one can live in Satan's world and Satan can do his worst, and we're still part of his, part of God's team. And we're going to stay on our feet. That's a great honor to fight with Christ. That is on his side.